today we're talking about Chinese history, and there's a number of themes. We're going to cover a staggering amount of time in this lecture. But predominantly, I'll focus on modern Chinese history from the First Opium War, beginning in 1839. Before that, we'll touch on a large slab of earlier times, and Chinese history is indeed a long story. So, themes. One is that China has 4,000 years of continuous civilization. Another theme is Han Chinese exceptionalism, and I'll explain what this means in more detail as we go along, but if you could encapsulate it in a football finals-like term, it's civilization versus barbarian. And the picture you see on the slide now of the Great Wall of China is emblematic of that worldview. What we see, another theme, is a transition from a feudal dynastic realm into a modern nation state. We see dynastic crime decline, and we see revolutions. We see China as a victim of imperialism, both from the West and from its neighbours in Japan. We see social and political chaos over this century-long period that I'm going to cover. And we see, within this context, the emergence of strong military figures. Key figures that we'll look at are the Empress Dowager Cixi, who is a very powerful figure in the Chinese imperial hierarchy of the late 19th and early 20th century. A controversial figure, a tragic figure, and we'll explore her further. Three other important people, post-1911 revolution. Sun Yat-sen, the father of modern China. Chiang Kai-shek, who is the leader of nationalist China. And Mao Zedong, who you all know as the founder of the People's Republic of China. Okay, China is commonly known as Trungguo, the Middle Kingdom, and it derives this name from its long history of civilization and its self-awareness as China as the centre of the world. Now, the picture you see here is a place called Tiantan, the Temple of Heaven in Beijing. Very interesting place, I've been there many times. Within this complex, near this building, there's a disc that says it marks the centre of the world. And again, this is emblematic of the Chinese worldview as Trungguo, as the Middle Kingdom, the centre of the world. So why then would the Chinese believe that their civilization occupies such a privileged position? This is an important question as we consider modern Chinese history, because we see China undergo a fall from grace from this very exceptionalist worldview through a period of chaos, and then in the modern era now, emerging from that period of chaos. So it's important to conceptualise this. Is China the oldest and richest civilization in human history? What do you think? Well, the Chinese will say yes, of course. You can trace it all the way back to the first figure on the top left, a hominid-like ape called Yuanbo Man, 1.7 million years ago, found in China. Trace through to the Yellow Emperor, the gentleman on the top right, who is the founder of China's dynastic succession 4,600 years ago. Through to modern figures, Sun Yat-sen, Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, and for those of you interested in NBA basketball, Yao Ming, who's pictured on the bottom, having his face superimposed on that of Neo from The Matrix. Although I'm pretty sure Yao Ming cannot stop bullets. So what we see here is a theme of a long unbroken tradition of human development and civilization. This graphic depicts that in an interesting way. James Lydall, who was in charge of this subject in previous years, this is a poster that he used to have on his wall, depicting this linear progress of Chinese civilization, right from the beginnings of Yuanbao Man, and right in the middle there, and unwinding all the way to the present day at the end in the top left. It's a long dynastic cycle, thousands of years of unbroken civilization here in graphic form. This is another way to look at China's history of dynastic succession. This traces back to 2000 years BC, before Common Era. What you see here is a succession of dynastic establishment, peaking, decline, and renewal. So when one dynasty atrophies, it all becomes corrupt, or it faces stronger challenges, it goes into decline, collapses, there's a period of chaos for a while, and then another dynasty takes over. And we see this stretches back a long way in Chinese history. Associated with this is an idea called the mandate to heaven. A very Chinese idea, where heaven blesses the rule of just rulers and withdraws the mandate of poor, incompetent, and unjust rulers. It's a legitimizing paradigm for leaders within this leadership succession context. So you find in history, if there was something like an earthquake or a large natural disaster, this would be a sign to the people that the present ruler's mandate of heaven had been revoked, and you could expect some kind of revolt or leadership changeover to come in the very near future after that. If we look at this graph, there's a few notable periods on here. If you look at the second yellow bar, the Warring States period, that's the time of Confucius, who you all know. And Confucian philosophy was developed in this period, which was one of political division and social chaos. And one of the themes of Confucian philosophy is bringing order to society from chaos. And so you can see why these ideas predominate when they were formed in this period of social chaos. You also see periods of dynastic strength, like the Han, the Dung, the Ming and the Qing dynasties. And those have been the most successful ones over the last two millennia. What this produces in Chinese political culture today is that Chinese thinkers, Chinese policymakers, Chinese leaders tend to look at politics and social development over much longer time horizons than their equivalents here in Western countries do. Chinese thinkers look at politics in terms of centuries. Here in the West, we look at politics in terms of the next opinion poll, the next electoral cycle. So this is a very big difference in political culture. Also, have a look at the bottom. I've added Australia, the length of time that Australia represents, the 210 years or so of Australian history, and where it sits in terms of China's dynastic succession. So that really puts into perspective this difference in timelines that I'm talking about. Throughout this period of dynastic succession, where China is the centre of the Asian system, international system, it's a Sino-centric system where surrounding countries, surrounding states or polities pay tribute to the Chinese emperor. The Chinese emperor was known as the Son of Heaven, and all other rulers or chieftains or kings owed fealty to him. And they would go on tribute missions where they'd go and give goods, jewels, valuable things as a tribute to the Son of Heaven. And they'd also do something called the kowtow, where they'd kneel down on one knee and pledge allegiance, pledge fealty to the emperor. This comes up again when we talk about the European powers' influence in the 19th century in China and their unwillingness to perform the kowtow, and that was a sign that the imperial system was coming to come under attack. If we look at some of the famous inventions that's come out of China over its long history, things like papermaking, gunpowder, the compass, or movable printing type. These are inventions that were invented in China well before they arrived in the West. And they arrived in the West via the Silk Road through Arabia and then into Europe. So China is the original place of these things. On the slide here, we see reference to the Ming Admiral Zheng He. And he went on a series of voyages into Southeast Asia and around the coast of the Indian subcontinent onto Arabia and East Africa. And on tribute-gathering missions, not colonisation missions, but gathering tribute for the Ming Emperor. And this really represents the high point, if you like, of Chinese imperial expansion into the outside world. And it's a significant moment, because this is the peak of Chinese interaction with the outside world prior to the modern era. And after this point, and we're talking 15th century here, after this time, Imperial China starts to suck in on itself, starts to become more insular. And this has consequences. Because of this insularity, you start to get less foreign ideas coming into the country. The intellectual class in China starts to atrophy, growing corruption of the government. And this really, from this high point, this is the beginning of the long decline that has its peak in 1949 at the end of the Chinese Civil War. So remember this. Interestingly, there's a few documentaries about Admiral Zheng He's voyages around the Indian Ocean, which you should be able to find on YouTube somewhere. So, the long decline. Beginning after that peak with Admiral Zheng He, but really starting to happen in the early 19th century. Now, last week we discussed China's many geographic, ethnic, and economic cleavages. And we ended by asking what this means for Communist Party rule and for the stability of the Chinese state. The period I'm about to cover, from 1839 to 1949, gives us a clue about why this is such an explosive and important question. Gives us a clue about why the Chinese government today is worried about splittist movements and social unrest. The long decline began in earnest in 1839 with the advent of the First Opium War fought with the British, but it had deeper roots. And some of these reasons for the decline, as I've said, insularity, a lost interest in the outside world after Zheng He's sea voyages, a lost interest in new ideas, and the lack of technological innovation as a result of this lack of new ideas. We saw a trend of weak leadership. So the Qing monarchy became weak, and the imperial bureaucracy became increasingly corrupt. And also we see a growing external interference. So even though China is becoming more insular, the outside world is starting to press upon China's borders. And China becomes a theatre for European and Japanese imperial expansion in the 19th century. Interestingly, this occurred at the same time as the Industrial Revolution was occurring in Europe. The long decline, as you'll see, is an enormous blow to the idea of the Middle Kingdom and notions of civilization and Han Chinese exceptionalism. A bit of ill, if you like. So the timeline, this is the timeline in visualisation of the period that I'm talking about. This is what I'm going to cover. So you'll note on the top of the graphic there's wars and periods of civil unrest. And then there's specific events listed on the bottom. Now you'll note that there's two waves of unrest here. The first, on the left-hand side of the graphic, are the two opium wars. Then you see a period of consolidation, probably not the right word, but it's where the Qing leadership is adjusting to these blows, but the final hammer is coming, and you can see that from about 1900 and the beginning of Japanese expansion into the Asian mainland, that this really heralds the end of the Qing dynasty and a long period of chaos. So let's get into it. First Opium War. Now, what I have here is a pipe, an opium pipe that I bought in Beijing. Very long. I'll leave it to your imagination as to how that works. But as you can see in the graphic on the top right of this slide, people used to sit around in opium dens and smoke this stuff all day and get completely stoned and rot their life away. So when you get a large slab of the population doing this, what aren't they doing? They're not working. They're not being productive members of society. If they already have jobs, they're not performing their assigned tasks. They might be stealing or committing other crimes to finance their opium habits. Again, this is a very familiar refrain to the drug problems that exist today. But this was happening in 19th century China. So why is this happening? Well, it's because the British pumped in a whole heap of opium into China to redress an imbalance in the terms of trade between the two countries. So in the 18th century, China exported a lot of luxury materials to Europe, and particularly to Britain. Britain didn't have anything to sell back, so they had to pay for it in gold and silver, which means China was raking in immense amounts of these precious metals at great expense to the British Treasury. So the British decided that they would grow opium in India and then ship it around the Straits of Malacca and into ports like Canton in southern China and sell it directly into the Chinese market. So by around the time of the first opium war, we're seeing up to one third of people in China are addicted to opium. I mean, this is a staggering amount. And you can, as I've just said, there's great socioeconomic problems that come with this level of addiction. Now, come 1939, Qing Dynasty imperial officials in Canton, or modern-day Guangzhou, near Hong Kong, they seized cargoes of British opium that were in ships in the harbour ready to be unloaded. The British interpreted this as an act of war, and in retaliation they won a series of decisive naval battles in southern China and also sent a fighting force up towards Beijing, and they got within 30 kilometres of the city before the emperor relented and decided to sign a peace treaty with the British. And this was called the Treaty of Nanking in 1842. After China's long period of isolation, this treaty opened up five ports for British traders, and they also ceded Hong Kong to Britain. So this is why Hong Kong became a British possession for so long. Now this treaty, the Treaty of Nanking, is the first of a series of what are considered unequal treaties. Treaties that prized open China to the detriment of the locals for the empowerment and the enrichment of foreign interests. Now over the intervening period between the First and Second Opium Wars, the Qing government didn't always and very rarely lived up to its obligations under the Treaty of Nanking. In part because it had lost faith and because it did consider that these treaties were unequal. The Second Opium War involved more than Britain, it involved other European powers as well, the French, the Americans and the Russians. And they were all keen to open China to their own traders as well. They didn't want this to be a British monopoly. Everyone saw China at that time as a great brand new market to exploit, and they were all keen for a piece of the action. So again, modern European military forces completely outgunning the antiquated imperial Chinese armies and naval forces, and this time European troops stormed the capital in Beijing, including looting the Summer Palace just outside Beijing, which is on the top of the top picture on this graphic here. And this resulted in one of the great cultural crimes of the 19th century, the looting of this iconic place. And there's a lot of European museums now that have a lot of relics from this period and from this particular event. The Second Opium War was concluded by the Treaty of Tianjin, which opened more ports to foreign trade, 11 in fact, in what was called the Open Door Policy. For the first time, it allowed, or the Qing government allowed, Western governments to send representatives to live in Beijing as ambassadors, which this had never been allowed before. The imperial capital was off limits to foreigners. And foreigners were also granted full freedom of movement throughout China. So again, when we're talking about opening China, they really were opening China up to foreign influence in a way that never happened in previous eras. And this went a long way to beginning to destabilise the imperial dynastic rule. This kind of destabilisation has domestic consequences. One of these is the Taiping Rebellion. So dissatisfaction with the Opium Wars, with the results here, led to a legitimacy crisis for the Qing government. There was also popular concerns about corruption within the Qing dynasty government. So this is a weak and faltering regime that a lot of people locally are very unhappy with. And at this time, we see a charismatic young leader from the south of China, a man called Hong Xiuquan, the leader of the Taiping. Now, this guy was a charismatic preacher. He preached a bizarre variant of Christianity mixed with anti-foreign and anti-imperial ideas, by foreign, imperial, and anti-dynastic ideas. So what did Hong do? He established an entity called the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom, which you can see in pink on the graphic here in southern China. He commanded an army of 30 million people. Now that's a staggering military force in size, isn't it? And this rebellion raged on 14, 15 years. So this was a very significant anti-Qing rebellion. It was eventually put down with the assistance of foreign forces, foreign troops already in China fighting the Opium War, the Second Opium War. So why did they intervene on behalf of the Qing government? Well, the Taipings being anti-foreign, the foreigners thought, European powers believed that the Qing government was easier to manipulate, easier to deal with than the very aggressive and radical Taipings would have been. So they assisted the Qing military in putting down this rebellion. But at great cost. This is the most costly civil war in the history of in modern human history. 25 million deaths. Further weakens the Qing leadership. And we also see a population outflow from southern China. And they end up in places like Victoria. So this is the period of the Victoria and New South Wales gold rush. We also see gold rushes in California in the United States at this time. And a lot of people from southern China make their way to these places to find a better life, economic opportunity, but also because they're fleeing a bloody civil war that's going on in their homeland. Now, this is a harbinger of chaos to come. Enter now Imperial Japan. This war, the first Sino-Japanese War, was fought between Qing China and the stirring power of Japan over a 9-month period, and was fought largely for control over the Korean Peninsula. Korea had traditionally been a Chinese vassal state. If I talked about the Sino-centric tribute system, Korea had been part of that network. Now, in the late 19th century, it becomes part of a three-way contest for influence between China, Russia, and Japan. Now, the European powers have been beating up on the Chinese military for 50 years. Now it's Japan's turn. The Japanese military had been brought up to Western standards very rapidly in the late 19th century as a result of the Meiji Restoration. And as a result, in this war, it's a comprehensive Japanese victory. The settlement at the end of it, called the Treaty of Shimonoseki, Japan takes the Liaodong Peninsula, which is just next to modern-day North Korea in the northeast, and it also takes Taiwan. Taiwan becomes a Japanese. China loses its grip on the Korean Peninsula, and China is also opened to Japanese trade. Very significant development. So this war and its outcome really opens the door for increasing Japanese penetration of the Asian mainland. In the wake of this humiliation, we see something called the 100 Days Reform in 1898. So the emperor at this time, the Guangxu emperor, ordered a series of legal, political and cultural social changes known as the 100 Days Reforms, which was he tried to emulate on Japan's Meiji Restoration, which had occurred 30 years earlier. So what did he try to do? He tried to modernise the traditional examination system for entry into the imperial bureaucracy. He tried to establish a modern education system with an emphasis on science and technology rather than solely looking at the Confucian texts or the Confucian classics. He tried to reform the economy on capitalist lines and kickstart industrialisation. And he tried to strengthen the military. So all very laudable aims, but they break down. Why? He tries to do them too quickly and without a real structural plan. This is too much for a conservative Confucian society, and it's too much for conservative factions within the imperial court. And these people, the conservative factions, interpret what the emperor is doing as a foreign plot. So remember, this is a very xenophobic period, characterised by a lot of foreign intervention, and this is the context in which the 100 Days Reforms are interpreted. The Empress Dowager Cixi, whom we see on the right-hand side of this picture here, is a member of this conservative faction in the court. And she deposes the Guangxu Emperor and takes control for herself in a coup. Now this is a shame for China at this time, because this is the last real opportunity that the imperial government had to launch some reforms. After this, the window's closed. Now this is an interesting graphic here. This is the Jade Boat of Purity and Ease, as it's called, at the Summer Palace. And this is a symbol of the corruption of the Empress Dowager Cixi. The money that she used to pay for this structure was slated to modernise China's navy at this time. So instead of modernising the navy, it's spent on this, the navy gets smashed by the Japanese, and that opportunity for self-defence is lost. The Empress amassed a huge personal fortune in China during her lifetime. And this is emblematic of that. Not long after, another rebellion. So I talked about this as a period of rebellions. Here's a very famous one, the Boxer Rebellion. And now these gentlemen on the left, they were called the Boxers because they practiced a form of martial art that the Europeans in China interpreted as boxing, but it had nothing to do with boxing. They'd been a secret society that had been around since the 17th century. But they became popular in the wake of the First Sino-Japanese War. So further humiliation, further impoverishment, further unequal treaties and foreign penetration. People are getting very angry, and the Boxers embody this anger. And they're very anti-foreign. They begin, they're against the treaty concessions of the two opium wars. They're against the penetration of opium throughout Chinese society. And they're also against Christian missionary activity, which has increased as China's been opened up over the 19th century. So from 1898, we begin to see the Boxers launch attacks on Christian missionaries throughout the country, particularly in regional areas. And the stories of these attacks are quite brutal. Missionary families who were very much exposed out in the hinterland being chased down, beheaded in some cases. A very brutal thing. The rebellion climaxes in 1901 when thousands of Boxers lay siege to the legation district in Beijing. So this is the embassy quarters, where all the foreign embassies are located in one or two blocks in Beijing. And this siege lasts for about a month and a half. The siege was supported by the Empress Dowager Cixi, because she wanted to channel the Boxer's venom away from her corrupt government and get them to take it out on the foreigners. But in the end, however, the siege is relieved by foreign troops. The Empress Dowager loses face, and foreign troops enter the Forbidden City in Beijing. Now, the reason why it's called the Forbidden City is because even common Chinese are not allowed in there, only the imperial court. So you see on the slide here the European troops entering the main courtyard of the Forbidden City. They sack this premises, again, take a whole lot of looting, cultural relics get taken out. The Empress flees and loses face, which further discredits the Qing leadership. Now, talked about the concept of face and losing face a couple of times now. So in these tutorials, it might be a good opportunity to ask what the concept of face means in the Chinese context. And the term bianzi, or face, is the one you should talk about. Today, there are a few remnants from in the legation district of the Boxer Rebellion period. This is the gate of the French legation, which is just to the east of Tiananmen Square in Beijing. Now, some of the buildings remain from this period. A lot of them have been smashed down and built over with more modern structures. But there are a few remaining, and I found this one on my recent visit in July. Now, a really important person in this period, Sun Yat-sen. He's China's Guo Fu, or National Father. He becomes the first president of Republican China. So we need to learn a lot about this man. This is a really important figure in the history of modern China. So what do we know about him? What do we know about Sun Yat-sen? Well, he was educated in Hawaii, where he went to live with his brother for a time. And this is an important educational opportunity for him. He learns about Western political philosophy. He learns ideas about democracy. And these ideas, as you'll see, will come to influence some of his later political thought. Now, initially, Sun blamed China's weakness on the alien Manchu barbarians. So let's remember, the Qing dynasty that had ruled for 300 years, they were foreigners from Manchuria. These are not Han Chinese. So a lot of these xenophobic feelings of Han Chinese at this period is not just directed at the Europeans or the Japanese, it's also directed at the Qing leadership, because they're interpreted as foreigners as well. So he established a revolutionary alliance, the Dong Meng Hui, which pledged to drive out the Manchu dogs and restore China, quote unquote, which earned him the wrath of the Qing government. He was forced into exile in 1905 because of this. So at the age of 29, he's in exile. He cuts off his queue. Remember the ponytail hairdo, which is a characteristic Manchurian hairdo. And this signifies his rebellion against the Manchu regime. And this picture here is him with some of his revolutionary counterparts while in exile. Sun described China as a loose sheet of sand, which was easily blown around by the superior material forces of the West. His solution to this dilemma is nationalism. And it's got three facets to this. Something he calls the Three People's Principles, which he formally presented in a series of lectures in 1924, but which heavily influenced his thinking right from the beginning of the Republican period in 1911. So, three facets to the People's Principles. One, Minzu Juyi, or the government of the people. This is a nationalist component. The second, Min Chuan Juyi, government by the people. It's So this is, he was talking here about a representative government under the tutelage of the state. And this is an outgrowth of his exposure to Western political philosophy. So here he's talking about establishing a representative elected parliament. And that's what we see when the Republic of China is established in 1912. The final component of his three principles is Minsheng Juyi, or government for the people, a state-directed modernisation. So this is the economic dimension of his plan, where he wants China to adopt the world's best practices and the world's best technologies in order to modernise the countries from the agricultural feudal society that it is, turn it into a modern country, just like Japan had done. Now, let's get to when it all goes down. This is the time of the revolution, 1911. And it begins in October of 1911 with the Wuchang Uprising. It begins as a local coup in Wuchang, which is in Hubei province. And it's led by revolutionaries who've got a faction within the modernising Qing army. Now, Sun Yat-sen is a leading figure in this group. And here he declares the inauguration of the People's Republic of China at Wuchang, a very pivotal moment. Even though he doesn't really have the power to do this across the whole country, the fact that he's done it is really important for setting off, it's a trigger moment, setting off the revolution more broadly. A revolution called the Xinhai Revolution. But let's back up a couple of years before we consider this. The Empress Dowager Cixi dies in 1908. And this leaves the power vacuum that was never properly filled after that. Her heir apparent was a young boy called Puyi. He was only 2 years old at the time. And you can see him sitting on his uncle's lap in the top right-hand picture. Now, clearly, someone of that age is in no position to rule. His regent, a man named Zefeng, was also politically weak, not in a position to exert influence. As a result of the Wuchang Uprising and the Xinhai Revolution, Puyi, under the discretion of his uncle, who was the regent, abdicated his position. That was the end of the Qing Empire, and the Republic of China was formed therefrom. What you see here, the picture in the middle, is of Shanghai in 1912. And it's displaying, there's all these flags, these are Republican flags that are being flown to celebrate the revolution. The flag's interesting because it symbolises, it's a symbol of China's ethnic diversity. It's five races. The Han, the Manchu, the Hui, the Mongols and the Tibetans. Each symbolised by a stripe on that flag. And it's after the revolution, Sun Yat-sen adopts this kind of unifying language. He talks about China as the Republic of the Five Races, hence this flag. And it brings up an important question about how to secure the legitimacy and unity of the new republic. After traditions and social and political structures that have existed for hundreds of years are wiped away. So in this flag, you see an attempt to inject that sense of legitimacy to the new regime that is very new, that is trying to start from scratch, and you need those legitimising anchors. So Sun Yat-sen becomes the first president of the Republic of China. And he also comes in leading a party called the Kuomintang, which he established in 1912 to carry out the three people's principles. This is the vehicle by which he's going to put these principles into practice. Now, problem. Sun Yat-sen doesn't have military backing. So it's hard to substantiate a claim to political power especially in a power vacuum at the end of a dynasty when you don't have people with guns supporting you. So he has to give up power to this gentleman on the right here, a man called Yuan Shikai. Yuan was a general in the Qing army. Yes, Yuan's a former general in the Qing army. He becomes the leader of the republic. And he begins to set himself up as the new emperor. Now let's see this. You can see there the arrows pointing at Yuan. He was being carried on a litter as if he was the emperor. This generated a lot of resistance. People had fought and died to overcome this type of power hierarchy. And Yuan Shikai comes in and tries to put himself in as the founder of a new dynasty. Now the problem with this is that he overreaches. People are not going to tolerate this. There's open protests against his regime all over China. International governments refuse to recognise his regime. Yuan supporters, his military supporters in the provinces start to desert him. And they declare their own autonomy. And this is important. You see, sections of the military start to cleave off. So this is the beginnings of a warlord period. This is the beginnings of a fragmentation of China. Something that all the players wish to avoid. So what we get is a power vacuum and a splintering. Now, within this vacuum, a very important social movement bubbles to the surface. It's called the May 4th Movement in 1919. And these were huge student demonstrations against the Beijing government and also against the Japanese. A huge national awakening. So why did this national movement come to the fore at this time? Well, it covered more than 20 provinces. There were protests in over 100 cities across the country. It's interesting because it has a broader popular legitimacy than the Xinhai Revolution in 1911 and 1912 that brought down the dynasty. So after Yuan Shikai's death in 1915, the beginning of the splintering of the country, it helps to rekindle the Republican Revolution. But the Republic is crumbling. What it does do, however, is it serves as an intellectual turning point for China. It radicalised Chinese intellectual thought. Because a lot of these students are not intellectuals, they're not rich intellectuals or privileged intellectuals from the governing Mandarin class. These are people from lower social strata that are beginning to be radicalised. It was anti-imperialist and anti-feudal. It brought the Chinese working class onto the political stage for the first time. And this included future members of the Communist Party. So this really sows the seed for the growth of the Communist Party that would end up taking over the leadership of China. And here, this is a monument to the May 4th movement in Beijing, just to the northeast of the Forbidden City. It's a rather innocuous sculpture on the edge of an intersection, but I'm really glad I found it, because this is such an important moment in the Republican period. But what we see after the May 4th movement, it doesn't succeed in unifying the country. The trajectory towards political fragmentation is too strong. And China was left without any centralised political authority. So the nation's army splinters in this time, competing warlords. So generals based in different regions around the country cleave off and become their own. Generals then have their own private armies as opposed to serving the government. So we see a couple of these guys in the picture here. Important warlords like James Warlin in the middle and Zheng Shuiliang on the left. Two of the most formidable of these warlords at the time, meeting with a Western military official. Now, this graphic, this is what a fragmented China looks like. Take it in. This is the fragmentation that occurred. So what are the features of this warlord period then? Well, the central government is obviously broken down into something like this. And key local level figures like generals assume control. But this has consequences, big consequences. We see the growth of criminal enterprises and the violent expropriation of resources from local communities. Now, because these local warlords, they're not real governments, they don't have taxation mechanisms, so to pay their way, they have to extract resources one way or another from the local community. And they do it with guns. Because this is happening, you're also seeing an increasing level of violence in society, which can't be checked because there's no legal framework within which grievances can be solved. Because remember, the state has fallen apart. You're ruling down the barrel of a gun. When you get a breakdown in the rule of law, you get this more violence. What does it do? Well, it impedes commercial activity. It impedes business. So this has significant effects on the economy, and you see an economic downturn as a result of this. And as all this is happening, social bonds begin to splinter as well. So your personal circle of trust begins to shrink down to the level of the family, or maybe even to a level of a few trusted individuals. Because you don't know. When people exist in this kind of environment, there's a very strong pressure to exploit other people. And so you need to know exactly who you can trust to get things done. So a cultural practice in China, Guanxi, establishing bonds of ongoing relationships for mutual benefit, which some Westerners interpret as a justification for corruption, but in historical periods like this is very important for being able to obtain resources and get things done in the absence of law and order. A moment in history like this often begets strong military leaders. Sun Yat-sen died in 1925, and this left a power vacuum in the Kuomintang. And this is a period of social unrest and political fragmentation. What we see is the rise of a man called Chiang Kai-shek. He emerges as the leader of the Kuomintang. You might know him as Jiang Jiushu from the Year 12 studies, but Chiang Kai-shek in the older Wei Zhao's romanization system of Chinese language is referred to as Chiang Kai-shek, and that's generally what he's called in the history books. Now, this is a military guy. He originates in the Wonghua Military Academy in the south. He's a strong man, he's got a strong personality type, and he comes to the fore in this period of political fragmentation, beating out other members of the Kuomintang for the leadership. Now, Chiang, as a strong military leader, manages to unite portions of the country in a series of expeditions. So in the south of China, he defeats three warlord armies and two independent armies in a period of 9 months. So he's able to establish a base in southern China and reclaim that from local warlords. Then he embarks as leader on something called the Northern Expedition, against the northern warlords. And here he has support with members of the fledgling Chinese Communist Party. So the communists are inaugurated in the early 1920s, and they join up with the Kuomintang. They're part of the Kuomintang at this time, and their goal is to reunify all of the country under centralized control. So here at the top of the slide, you can see a number of Kuomintang troops on the northern expedition ready to fight the northern warlords. Another important person on this slide in the bottom right is a man called Zhou Enlai, who was also a military man, from the same military academy as Chiang Kai-shek, but he would go on to become a very important member of the Chinese Communist Party until he died in 1976. Now, because of ideological differences, this united front between the communists and the nationalist Kuomintang was never likely to last very long. And indeed, it didn't. So by 1926, the Kuomintang is divided into left-wing and right-wing factions, as well as the communist bloc. So there's lots of different blocs within the party, which makes for tense relations within the organisation. Early 1927, this split explodes. The communists and the left wing of the Kuomintang moved their seat of nationalist government to the city of Wuhan. In response to this, Chiang Kai-shek sends his right wing Kuomintang supporters to Shanghai and establishes an anti-communist movement there, purges and kills a lot of communist supporters. This is the genesis of the nationalist-communist split at this time. Now, there's a result here of the nationalist-communist split. One, you have three different regimes in China. You've got the internationally recognized warlord regime that's still in Beijing. It hasn't been recaptured yet. You've got the communist regime in Wuhan. And you've got the Kuomintang regime in Nanjing, which is now modern-day Nanjing. And this would remain the Kuomintang capital for the next decade. So eventually, in the Northern Expedition, Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalist forces recapture Beijing. And once they've done this, they become the internationally recognized government representing all of China. They have their capital based in Nanjing, in the center of the country, and they also bring the communists to the brink of defeat in a series of military engagements across southern China. Now, this leads to an event of folklore in communist China, the Long March. After a series of battles, the Kuomintang have the communists on the run in 1934. The communists are forced to escape. They go on this long march. You can see it's not really one march, but there's a series of marches as different communist armies are on the run and they attempt to join up and link up in Yan'an. About 100,000 communists set out on this very long retreat march, the Long March. Only 5,000 make it to Yan'an in the end. So extremely high rates of attrition for the communists. But what does happen from the legend of this event is it establishes Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai as key figures within the Communist Party. This is where Mao Zedong comes to prominence within the party. This is the seed of his later leadership, is in this event. So it's a very pivotal moment in the development of the Communist Party. But the nationalists don't win. They don't end up crushing and defeating the communists. The civil war is still alive. Indeed, the communists are bailed out. And we'll get to that in a minute. So yeah, results of the Long March. For one, it gave the communists some breathing space to recuperate from the Kuomintang onslaught. So once they get to Yan'an, then they have time to regenerate and lick their wounds. It also creates a legend that would help the Communist Party win support, particularly from the peasants who supported them along the road of the Long March. And this had proved decisive. At the end of the Pacific War, when the Civil War recommences, because the peasantry became a huge support base for the communists, for the Communist Party later on. And the third development here is that Mao Zedong rises to the undisputed leadership of the Communist Party. And here you can see him in the middle picture of the slide. So I talked about the communists also being bailed out. And they were bailed out because of Japanese expansion into China proper, into the Second Sino-Japanese War. So in Australia, we think that World War II is starting in 1939 with Hitler's invasion of Poland. But if we count the whole Pacific War, it started much earlier with Japan's expansion into the Asian mainland. And the Chinese were fighting the Japanese well before we were. So Japan's expansion in China brought the Chinese Civil War to a pause. They'd invaded Manchuria in the northeast in 1931. This is the Japanese. They'd set up a puppet state there called Manchukuo. And they'd set up the last emperor, Puyi, the last Qing emperor, as the puppet ruler of Manchukuo. And then Manchuria was their base for expansion southward. And in 1937, this occurred. So let's have a look at a map. July 1937, the Japanese take Beijing, they take Shanghai, and they also take a number of other strategic ports along the Pacific coast, which you can see there. Now, important points to capture here. Notice in that red dot, the Japanese occupation covers areas that are controlled by the nationalist Kuomintang forces, but they never get to the point of invading the communist heartland. Now, this is important to the later outcome of the Civil War. Because Nanking is taken by the Japanese, the Kuomintang have to move their capital and command base to Chongqing on the upper reaches of the Yangtze River. And they're not in their heartland now. So this is a destabilizing impact of the Japanese invasion. Now, when the Japanese took Nanking, this is known as one of the great atrocities of the Japanese occupation, known as the Rape of Nanking. So after capturing the city, the Japanese military goes on a six-week rampage, murders approximately 300,000 disarmed soldiers and civilians, residents of the city. And this is the most infamous incident of the Japanese occupation on the Asian mainland. Now, this is still a contentious issue today. Some people in Japan say that these statistics are exaggerated. And, of course, you can imagine the kind of emotions that this stirs up amongst Chinese. And it's also because of this history war, and it's one of a number of history wars surrounding the 1930s and 40s between China and Japan, this is a real ongoing irritant in Sino-Japanese relations. The Japanese invasion it stops the civil war in China, but it also gives the communists and the Kuomintang little choice but to join forces because now they have a mutual enemy. So they come up with a truce called the Second United Front. Now apparently Chiang Kai-shek didn't come to this truce willingly. He had to be abducted by two of his leading generals and convinced by force that this is something that he should do. So the result is it suspended the Chinese Civil War for almost a decade. And you can see here pictures from this period, Mao and Chiang Kai-shek presenting a united front in their fight against the Japanese. Naturally, this was not bound to last, like the first united front. So 1944, the Pacific War is nearing an end. Chinese forces, in collaboration with the Americans and the British, are making serious inroads into the Japanese foothold in China. Eventually, the Japanese are expelled. The end of the Pacific War is also the end of the United Front between the Kuomintang and the communists. And the civil war's back on. But this time, the tables have turned. A number of things have changed between 1937 and 1945. Now, for one, the Kuomintang, its support base was confined largely to the cities, largely to among the gentry and the merchant classes. So these are people that are relatively well off and they live in the cities. And they're a conspicuous minority within what is largely a rural agricultural society in China. Because of the war, the Chinese economy was sacked. It was costly, there was spiraling inflation, cost of living pressures for ordinary people. And the nationalist government had become extremely corrupt and was exacting an increasingly large taxation burden on ordinary people that they couldn't live with. And this was a cause of great indignation. So the tax burden on the peasants in particular was one of the things that pushed peasants en masse to support the communists instead of the nationalists in the Civil War. But most importantly, the Kuomintang were exhausted militarily from fighting the Japanese. They had done a majority of the fighting, while the communists were able to sit back and regroup in their stronghold in Yan'an, away from the occupation zone. Although the communists did do some fighting, on the whole, they were able to regroup while the nationalists exhausted themselves fighting the Japanese. The communist army was able to foster a strong image as guerrilla fighters fighting to defend the people, fighting to defend the peasants and the rural classes. And remember, China's an agrarian society. Not only were they able to use this imagery to attract people from the rural areas to support them rather than the KMT. So we see the Communist Party. 1937, they have a membership of 100,000. In 1945, they have 1.2 million. So that's an extraordinary rate of growth over the course of the Second United Front. So that change, that membership base changes the goalposts of the military mass as the Civil War recommences. Over the coming 4 years, the communists are able to grind down the Kuomintang armies, and they eventually win. The nationalists are forced to flee to Taiwan. Chiang Kai-shek takes 2 million people across the Taiwan Strait, who set up camp in Taiwan as refugees. And this is, of course, the beginning of, it's the genesis of the China-Taiwan problem. And at the bottom of this slide, bottom right-hand corner, you can see communist troops entering Beijing in 1949, entering triumphant. On the top right, you can see Mao speaking with peasants, speaking as equals. So that really plays into the idea that the communists were able to attract the support of the peasantry. And Mao's political abilities as a guerrilla fighter, and also as a charismatic leader, were big factors in this. So that's it, the Civil War's finished. The communists win. October 1, 1949, Mao Zedong proclaims the inauguration of the People's Republic of China in Beijing, atop the gates of the Forbidden City in Tiananmen Square. A seminal moment. I'll show you a video of this next week. So I've covered a lot of ground here. Modern Chinese history, particularly this period of long decline. So much goes on. There's so much social chaos, and it's very difficult to try and encapsulate the degree to which the Chinese state's decayed and splintered and fragmented. Where the economy dips into chaos, where social bonds are broken down, where political allegiances are fluid. It's a messy period of history. So what's its legacy? Well, I'm going to outline three broad areas of the legacy of this period. The first one is to do with Chinese nationalism. Now, the impact of this torrid period of history still influences Chinese nationalism today. Now, generally in Chinese nationalism, there's two strands evident. One, as I said before, is that idea of Han Chinese exceptionalism. The idea that China has 4,000 years of unbroken civilization. As China, as the center of the world, as an exceptional nation. Now contrast that with the history of the period I've covered today, where you see a different nationalism emerge, a nationalism of China as the wounded nation, China as the victim of foreign powers, China as the victim of internal division. And here you can see an event like the rape of Nanking as a real rallying symbol for this victim strand of nationalism. It's xenophobic of anti-foreign, but it has its genesis in this period of chaos. And here, the slide depicts a picture from the Nanking Massacre Museum in Nanjing today. Now, both of these two strands of Chinese nationalism are evident today. So you might see them in the ongoing history wars with Japan. Issues to do with the Japanese textbooks and the interpretation of the Pacific War that's offered in them is a real cause for disquiet. Not only in China, but also in Korea and elsewhere in Asia. We see these two strands of nationalism in the 2008 Olympic torch relay around the world, where there was a lot of protests surrounding the torch relay, often led by pro-Tibet supporters. But there was an equally strong and sometimes stronger reaction of ethnic Chinese around the world defending the torch relay. And we saw that here in Australia and Canberra too. And you might remember in the year 2000, the Chinese downed an American spy plane over Hainan Island. And the fallout from that incident was also emblematic of this. It'd be a good idea if you look up that incident, it's quite interesting. Legacy number two is the impact of this period on China's political culture. So on the slide here, a very famous image, I'm sure you've all seen it, the Tank Man image from 1989 and the Tiananmen Square incident. The Communist Party had a very strong military response to the Tiananmen protests at this time. Why might that be? Well, this is emblematic of the deep impact that China's period of long decline has left on the Communist Party leadership. They have an acute awareness of China's geographic, ethnic, economic and cultural diversity. They have a great concern about social unrest and splitterist movements. In the period we've covered today, we've seen a number of rebellions. We've seen the country fragment and the state collapse. We've seen 2,000-year-old dynastic system crumble apart into something completely new. This is an unprecedented era of chaos. So the Communist Party leadership now cannot help, as the child, as the product of this period of chaos, they cannot help but be aware that this could happen again. And this is definitely influences their thinking. Consequently, there's a definite willingness to use force to put down social unrest. The Tiananmen Square incident is one example. The reaction to the riots in Lhasa in Tibet in 2008, I think it was, is another example. Sending the military to Urumqi in Xinjiang province a couple of years later to put down unrest there. another example. Having said that, especially since the Deng Xiaoping era from 1976 onwards, we've seen the Communist Party is also willing to use force, but they also are reactive to some of the demands of these protest movements. So they do satisfy some of the demands of the protesters. Punishment plus, as carrot stick, punishing the leaders, but also giving in and satisfying some of the lesser demands of protest. We also see the Communist Party is cautious about political reform, and they approach change incrementally rather than radically. So overall, we see the Communist Party, they're concerned about the possibility of revolution and another fragmentation of Chinese society, with some justification, I think you'll agree. The third legacy I'd like to cover before we wind up today is to do with the key players, three key players in the story I've just told. So Sun Yat-sen, the father of modern China, his political thought was the inspiration for both the Kuomintang and the Chinese Communist Party. And he's revered on both sides of the Taiwan Strait today as well. You'll find Sun Yat-sen memorials in Taipei and in China. What about Chiang Kai-shek? After 1949, the Republic of China was maintained in Taiwan, and Chiang was president until his death in 1975. The Kuomintang remained in power. Taiwan was a one-party dictatorship until the mid-1990s, and there's still an active political party in Taiwanese politics today. Mao Zedong, well, we'll explore him in great detail next week, so I won't go into him now. So anyway, that's a wrap for modern Chinese history from 1839 to 1949. Next week, when we examine the Chinese economy, or is it politics? No, we're examining Chinese politics next week. We'll look at the communist era from 1949 onwards, and we'll look at Mao Zedong's term as leader, and we'll contrast that with the Deng Xiaoping era and how the political dynamics in China have changed over the course of the last 60 years. So thanks for your attention. Thank you in Melbourne.
Thank you.